This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Lori Daybell.
Lori effing Daybell, as we like to refer to her around here. Oh my gosh, the trial is underway. I've been watching as much as I possibly can of it. We've been bringing you a lot of clips, the opening statements on both sides, and kind of breaking down stuff piece by piece. But a man who's been literally watching it play by play, Bob Mata, defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries. I'm going to throw it to you because you've seen more of this than I have thus far. What the hell's your take on it?
Well, number one, hey, what's up, T?
Hey.
It's been a minute.
Yeah.
Welcome back. Welcome back.
Thank you. You too.
It's boring so far.
Yes.
It's like the key kind of phrase that I can think of, the best way to describe it thus far. It's like any state case, it kind of clunks out of the gate a little bit. And, you know, they're putting on the witnesses, kind of building the timeline. And, you know, ultimately we'll start getting into the juicier stuff in terms of the real evidence that can prove that she was a part of the conspiracy. But right now we're just, you know, with the first responders, you know, the first cop to the scene, hear a little bit from those folks, and then kind of like forced to listen through Lori's inane cross-examinations where it's hard to describe what she's doing. She's not. Like, she's asking all these questions. It feels more like a deposition.
Yeah, like, what I'm trying to put my finger on what direction she's trying to go, because I don't know that she knows what she's trying to do, where she's trying to go or what she's trying to do.
She doesn't. She has no idea. Yeah. I mean, you can't.
No.
You know, I mean, trying a case is not easy. It's not easy for lawyers, and it's certainly not going to be easy for somebody who's tried to prep themselves in prison.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's going to be a very challenging endeavor for her, you know, but do I feel any pity? Absolutely not. She made her choice. She's mm-hmm. the smartest person in the room. So, you know, she's going to reap what she sows through the end of this thing. And, you know, ultimately I have very little doubt that she'll be found guilty. I will say that as far as her opening went, she was competent. You know, I mean, I didn't think that she was like a bumbling fool up
yeah,
there.
Yeah.
I thought that she had a pretty linear timeline. I thought that she kind of like hit her points. You could tell that she had worked on that for a long time. You could tell her advisory counsel told her to use the phrase, the evidence will show, over and over and over. You know,
like to a fault. It was like, I think she thought she had to begin every sentence with it, no matter what, even if she was talking about evidence or not.
Right, exactly. Well, and the interesting thing is that she made a lot of promises, mm-hmm. right? I mean, she made a lot of promises with that phrase, the evidence will show. And I don't know how she's delivering any of that to the jury short of her testifying, because everybody that was in that home is no longer with us.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, I mean, she's literally the only person who's alive that could get any of that into evidence as to what happened in that house. So, I mean, it raises the question, is she going to testify? Now, that poses a huge issue for her, because that's what brings in her criminal record,
mm-hmm.
her background. If she testifies, the state gets to bring her entire criminal history in. And, you know, whether or not these jurors know about her, it's hard to say. I imagine that some of them probably do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, that's a real battle for her. You know, I mean, that's just because of human nature. I mean, they're not supposed to take those convictions into consideration in terms of whether or not she's guilty of this crime. But that's not how human beings work.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not what we do. You know, I mean, it's all kind of part and parcel of the same story, isn't it? It doesn't really matter that things took place at different times. It was all part of the grand scheme of things. So,
yeah.
You know, whether or not the jury's aware of it, if she decides that she's going to testify, it's all coming in. You know, I mean, it has to. So, because that's part of the deal. You know, if you get on, because they have the ability to be able to challenge your credibility. And one of the ways of doing that is bringing in your criminal history. So,
Is that like pretty much though a guaranteed you're going to be found guilty, Lori Vallow, if you decide to testify in this? I mean, it almost, I mean, no matter, I don't see anything she's possibly going to say by testifying herself that would outweigh bringing in JJ and Tylee's death. I don't know what that could possibly be.
I agree. And you know, it's kind of it's a double-edged sword for her because it at the heart of it, it is a defense of others slash self-defense type defense that she's putting on in terms of she's claiming that her brother was defending Tylee and, you know, that's why this whole thing went down. And, you know, short of her getting on to the stand and saying what happened in there, how is she getting that story out? You know what I mean? Yeah. And it, like, so it's like, if she doesn't do it, I just don't know how she's going to deliver on her side of the story at all.
You know, yeah, there's really nobody else in there. There's no one that's alive that can speak to this anymore. Right. Were you surprised? I mean, no, I was a little bit surprised. Let's go back to the opening statements that we had from Lori. My bar was pretty low on this of what to expect. I was surprised actually how well she did on her opening arguments there. And I was also surprised that she didn't bring religion into it at all yet. I was expecting some, you know, zombie-ish something in there, but she seemed to have enough competence to go, maybe not yet, or maybe not at all. I don't know. What was your reaction to that?
Yeah, same. And, you know, the state had, they certainly didn't dive deep into the religious side of it either. They certainly brought up like the knee-high stuff, you know, because they're going to tie that up, and they're going to do that with respect to what, you know, translating what these text messages between Lori and Alex meant, you know, and they're like, those are going to be the smoking gun evidence for them, and they're going to have to bring it in to a certain extent, whether or not it's going to be anywhere near what we saw in the first trial. I don't think so.
Yeah.
And I don't think that they should. I think this is a much cleaner story for the state without having to get into all of that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, they're not having to really create the narrative for the jury as to like how this mother came to ending her own two children's lives like they did the first time, wherein, you know, showing kind of like where her brain had gone in its delusional state with respect to thinking that the kids were demons and they were no longer, you know, in there, and that they were just vessels. And that it was like, so, you know, it's like for that kind of stuff, they had to bring that in because they had to be able to show, look,
yeah,
this is where her head was. Like, this is why she did it. This was her motive. And, you know, and I mean, they charged her with, you know, still collecting the Social Security benefits, but like that wasn't enough money to be a true motive. Like they had to show that she was just warped, you know, that she, like, this is what she was thinking, that she thought the end of days were coming. She didn't think that her kids were her kids anymore. And that was the reason. Here, it's a very different case for them in the sense that I think they have to bring a little of it in, but they don't have to bring in the full weight of it, which I think is good, you know, because I think it'll get confusing to the jurors if they're not going to go all in. Like that's just not a story you can kind of cherry pick a few things and throw it in there. And if you've got jurors that are not familiar with her story and the background of the case, they're going to be like, what? Like, what does any of this mean? You know what I mean? Because like I kind of felt when I was listening to the state's opening statements that it was a little disjointed. I thought I didn't think it was bad, but I thought it was a little kind of a little hit or miss in terms of like, is the jury able to discern what they're getting at here?
Yeah.
You know, it's like kind of stick on the bigger things like, okay, well, Charles had the life insurance policy, money was the motive here, you know, and ultimately she wanted to be with Chad. So she had these two things that were going on, and without really having to dive deep into the religious side of it, you know, but I mean, there is a like a pretty big Mormon population in Arizona as well.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not as if, you know, you're trying to tell this story to like a Chicago jury, mm-hmm. where, you know, Mormonism and LDS isn't as big out here.
Yeah.
You know, where you're going to have a lot of people like, what does any of this mean?
You get laughed out of the room. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, we'll see how it plays out, but, you know, to me, the biggest question is going to be whether or not she's going to testify.
What's your thoughts on the story that she's presenting, in her opening arguments, that it was, Alex was trying to defend Tylee from a rageful Charles Vallow who was going to swing a bat at her, although there really had been no documented abuse whatsoever between Charles and the kids. And I'm wondering with that, you know, we said nobody's around to talk about. Colby is.
Yeah, for sure. Now, I don't think Colby was living with them at the time.
I know.
But we do know that Colby and Tylee talked all the time.
Yeah.
You know, I think they were tight. So in terms of, you know, but then that becomes a hearsay situation. How was he able to get in those conversations?
Sure.
So, I mean, she represented that there was like some video that exists, as to some of these interactions between Charles and Tylee. How she's going to get those in, or if they really exist.
That's the question. Do they exist? You know?
Right. You know, so, I mean, we're going to have to wait and see. You know, I mean, that's going to have to be her story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was always, that's what I was saying. I mean, she's coming in with this defense of another situation, and I just don't know how she gets there without testifying, man. I just don't.
I don't know. I'm trying to understand what the big deal with the CPR argument has been thus far, because we've been hearing it from the state and from her. What's the point of this argument? We know he was shot. The first officer has said, you know, when I got there, he was not revivable. It was one of those things. It just is what it is. But there seems to be like, I don't know where she's going with her arguments, and it may be absolutely nowhere, but it still seems to be somewhat of a focus. I mean, as of today, as of where we're at with technically day three of the trial as we're recording this.
Yeah, I think that her bigger purpose was there was a 47 minute gap from the time that they think that Charles was shot to when Alex calls 911.
Sure.
You know, I mean, the argument from the state certainly would be that they had to make sure that he was dead and that he was not revivable before they called 911. So that's kind of their thing. And then the other part of it is that the state's going to insinuate that Alex never actually tried to do CPR on him.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where you got into the cracking of the sternum.
Yeah.
And, you know, why that kind of stuff hadn't happened, and would blood be gushing out of the wound if Alex had been performing CPR on the chest. So that was kind of her thing. She was trying to establish that they don't have any way of proving that Alex did not perform CPR, because that's a damaging fact for, you know, for Lori and for Alex Cox in terms of their narrative that he shot in self-defense and that, you know, he was directed by 911 to try to revive him and, you know, talking him through the CPR. And, you know, the state's narrative is going to be that he didn't try anything. He just sat there looking at him. So that's what she was trying to get in. I think that was the purpose of a lot of her questions, was to establish that, you know, somebody who's not familiar with doing CPR and isn't, you know, doing the compressions with the amount of pressure that you need to, that they wouldn't necessarily have broken that sternum and cracked ribs trying to press down. Whereas with first responders who know what they're doing and whose number one, you know, goal is to get that person resuscitated, you know, oftentimes they will crack bones when they're trying to do it, because you're trying to get to the heart in order to get that thing pumping again. So, you know, I think that was ultimately what her point was, because at the end of the day, it's going to be pretty damaging facts for Lori in terms of whether or not Alex actually tried to resuscitate him. So, you know, I mean, I think she did what she could. She's got obviously no medical background.
Yeah.
And, you know, her trying to cross-examine people that have, you know, knowledge and experience in doing that was pretty clunky.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.